part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Thank you for coming on. I mean, I really appreciate you doing this. And, you know, I should say your name, first of all. It's Mike Weatherford, correct?
That's it. Thank you.
Nice. For some reason, I had the name Mike Weatherby stuck in my head. And I'm like, where is that coming from? And I'm like, no, it's Mike Weatherford. Mike Weatherford. So
I'm a Genesis fan. And then when Mike and the Mechanics were a big deal, I got Mike Rutherford all the time.
Oh, really? That's funny. That's great. That's great. Well, we should say that my name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. But you are on because you have a current Kickstarter going, correct?
I do. We're just about done with the first week as we speak.
Nice, nice. And it's for a book called Drive-In Kings of 1977.
That's it. It's a trip back to that pivotal year when a certain space movie came along and started the irreversible, perhaps, decline of the drive-in, or at least the drive-in as both a physical place and a genre. Uh-huh. The drive-ins that are still around pretty much run the same movies you can see indoors now, but sure, it wasn't always the case.
Sure. Are there still, I was thinking about it while I was reading your book earlier this morning, and you were nice enough to provide me the first two issues. And first of all, I should say it's fun, and it's really great for like fans of this type of thing, or like B movies, or like 70s stuff, 70s and 80s things. I mean, it's very reminiscent of sort of the, you know, 80s kids get into a really weird adventure, but you also have a little bit of a more like late teen, I don't want to say like grown up twist to it, but like, you know what, it's like Stranger Things, but with a little bit more of a maturity, like, added to it. Am I hitting that on the nail, hitting that nail on the head correctly at all? Or
yeah, or the one that I used to cheat with is the Richard Linklater movie Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, okay.
When that was on basic cable one time when my daughter was in middle school, and I almost whistled her down, and I was almost like, hey, if you want to see what your dad's high school years were like compared to you's, sit down and watch this. But then I kind of stopped and I go, I really want to like bust myself this bad? It was this close.
That's funny. That's funny. No, I mean, it's great because, I mean, these are everything that you're sort of like referring to in this series is, I mean, I think we may be in the same age range as stuff that I very much like enjoyed either as a teen or in my 20s as I got to know different movies and, you know, be exposed to like different sort of things when looking into cinema and things like that. Do you want to just like sort of, again, it's like, I always joke around with guests, like in the beginning, like, do you want to give like the elevator pitch? We should just call this the elevator pitch podcast. Cause I always say elevator pitch, but what is your sort of like quick summation of what Drive-In Kings is like,
Well, sure. On my Kickstarter page, I have Animal House meets Grindhouse. That's kind of close. I had these three teen kind of pranksters, and I didn't want them to be like the jocks or the nerds. You know, I want them just be more of a blend, like people you really grew up with that weren't all one thing or something else.
Yeah.
But they get get pulled through the drive-in screen by a stranded alien buried beneath their Kingswood Estate station wagon. And they go on a rescue mission for him, and they end up in a world that looks a lot like the movies they love at the drive-in.
Yeah.
And those movies are, as the first issue explains, roughly the late 50s until 1977.
Yeah. And this is a period piece, right? It takes place in 77, right? Like, I mean, because there's a drive-in theater and stuff like that. And like, that's the time period. Because, I mean, the book is called Drive-In Kings of 1977, right?
Right. And that year is picked on purpose. You know, that is, I think a few people know that's the year Star Wars came out. And it wasn't overnight that the movie industry kind of flipped, but in the next few years, obviously, it completely flipped to where the genre movies, you know, the sci-fi and the horror and the things that used to be the low budget stuff you saw at the drive-in became, as we all know, that became mainstream Hollywood and the tent poles and the summer blockbusters. And now, you know, the adult drama things like American Fiction or the small independent movies. So I wanted to set it in that year where, you know, the kids that are the stars of the book don't know it, but the reader knows that this is the year things where the drive-in only had a few more summers of being the drive-in as far as what you see there versus just the place you go to see it.
That's so interesting what you just brought up, and I've never really thought about it, is how, like, when we were growing up, you know, the mature stuff was, you know, stuff like Chinatown or, you know, I'm just reaching for like mainstream movies. Like, you know what I mean? Like, stuff with Dustin Hoffman. You know what I'm talking about? And then,
Right,
and
that great decade of the 70s, you know, with the one network, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, all those, yeah.
And that stuff was like the mainstream stuff. And now it's like completely flipped, where it's like genre stuff, like stuff with drag. Like when we were growing up, it was hard to find something that was sci-fi or had sci-fantasy or fantasy, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons kind of stuff that actually seemed decent. Like you would watch it because it was there, because that's kind of like what you were into and that's the best you could get. But the effects were dodgy and the lighting, and you know, there was tons of that stuff like on VHS in the 80s, but it wasn't considered mainstream. And now everything is flipped, where it's like serious dramas are getting hard to get made and seen. And now, like, the big things are like, you know, the Marvel stuff and anything with, you know, the House of Dragons and stuff like that. That's so crazy that we're in
Yeah,
this
you know
place.
the when I watch the modern Marvel movies like the recent Doctor Strange, and I go like, you know, the kids today don't complain, but to me it's like more happens in the first 10 minutes than ever happened in any movie I grew up with or saw at the drive-in in the whole movie. And it's almost like, to me, it gets tedious by the end of the movie. I'm sure a younger person would completely disagree with that, but it's almost like too much for one movie. But the Tarantino movie, Death Proof, you know, half of the Grindhouse double bill, whether he did it on purpose or not on purpose, and with him it was probably on purpose. It was very talky for the first two thirds of it, and then all the action in the last third of it, and that was completely away a lot of these movies we sat through at the drive-in. You know, it took them a long time for their limited payoff.
It's just so, that's such an interesting point that you kind of like bring up, because I never really thought about it. Because even just trying to track down some of the stuff that's nominated for Oscars these days, like right now we're sort of like in the award season, it's like you have to like dive into the streaming and search and maybe pay, you know. But if it's like a Marvel movie or like a DC movie or something sci-fi or fantasy, it's just part of like the fabric of our pop culture right now, which is so kind of crazy. I don't know if that's good or bad. Like, I don't know how to, you know, approach that. But I was also thinking, and that's just kind of what I wanted to say earlier when we started chatting, is I don't think like I don't think I've ever been to a drive-in theater, like to see a movie. Like, can you talk to me a little bit about that experience? Like, where did you grow up and see.
Oh, well, we gotta go, man. We gotta go
I've
to one.
never been to one. I just figured, like, at this point, I know, is the quality any good? Like, sitting in the car with your car speakers, like, how does it? I mean, I'm sure the modern experience is much more different than, you know, in the 60s and 70s or the 50s or whatever. If you watch like Grease and stuff like that, like the old Grease movie where they're at the drive-in, but I've been to like drive-ins that have been converted to, like, you know, flea markets and stuff like that, but I've never been to see like a movie. So I'm assuming that that was part of your growing up, that you did that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first I'll say that, yeah, digital projection really helped a lot. It was one case where there are 35 millimeter purists, but
sure.
A lot of other people will agree that the surviving drive-ins changing over to digital greatly enhanced the ability to see what's actually on the screen there. And then the sound comes over your car radio now, where as long as your battery doesn't die, that's an improvement, because you're separated out stereo sound in your car.
Oh, God.
But to go back to your actual question there, it's funny that drive-in fanatics, it's kind of like, we all have some kind of common DNA, but we can't really explain it. But it usually goes back to our childhood and early memories of having your parents take you when you were a little kid, and you fall asleep in the back seat.
Yeah.
Sometimes even you come to the drive-in in your pajamas. And there's just something about when it gets dark and those previews come on that used to involve the dancing ice cream bars, things like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was just something kind of magic about that summer night, you know, when you kind of start to hear the insects and the big giant, it's always a big giant screen, or it usually is, fires up, definitely bigger than anything you see at a multiplex now.
Sure.
That's usually the kind of common memory, the common DNA that people are obsessed with the drive-in. That's usually the memory we all share. But more pertinent to the book is the teenage bad boy years there,
yeah,
where the drive-in was just a place where you could go and act up and be left alone. You know, if you could score beer at the convenience store and take it in, and you know, it was still a little bit pre VHS back then, and you could see the R-rated stuff. It beat just, you know, again, going back to Dazed and Confused, it beat congregating in parking lots and having the cops come up and chase you away.
Sure.
Things like that.
Do you recall, like, what the first movie you might have seen, like, in a drive-in was or might have been? Do you have an early memory of, like, what the first theatrical experience was, or what the emotional component of that experience? Was it scary? Was it cool? Like, what was it like, you know, kind of being taken to that?
As a little kid, I have two movies, and one's a short answer and one's a long answer.
I definitely
remember seeing The Ghost and Mr. Chicken as a little kid, and that might be the first time I was at the drive-in.
Uh-huh.
There was another, this will really put your listeners to the test if I delay the reveal here. There was another one that much of my life went by, and I couldn't figure out what movie it was, that I just remembered the beginning before I fell asleep in the back seat, that it was a woman who was pretending to be a mermaid, and a fisherman hooked her, and her mermaid suit came off, and she was swimming and begging him, like, hey, kind of naked in the water here, you need to give me my swimsuit back.
Uh-huh.
And it's not something I thought about every day, but years went by. And one day, just probably on Turner Classic or something, I was flipping channels and landed on it. And lo and behold, there it was. And it's a Doris Day comedy called The Glass Bottom Boat.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've ever seen that one. Oh,
you're not missing much, really.
That's funny. Well, talk to me a little bit about, like, your protagonist, because, I mean, earlier on, I reached for Stranger Things, like, just, you know, an easy comparison. But these characters are a bit different. I would say maybe they are a little bit older, at least, you know, when that show started. And they're sort of, for lack of a better term, mischievous, right? Like, they're doing pranks on, like, sorority girls. They're not necessarily the most popular sort of, like, kids in school. Like, they're more, like you said, Animal House guys, right?
Right. I wasn't sure quite what I was going for, except I, you know, one of those things where you know what you don't want it to be, and you don't, we've all seen the nerds and the jocks and the basic stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of go back to you know, write what you know, the a little bit autobiographical, but like they mentioned, there's things in there that are definitely me and my friends, and one of them is the prog rock references. That even recently, I saw Rick Wakeman in a solo piano concert and telling stories, and he said, the stories I'm going to tell are all a mixture of truth and lies, but it's up to you to determine the percentage. And so that's kind of, a lot of these are our high school days, but as they've sort of been amplified or changed or retold in the telling over the years.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted a little bit of that kind of jackass edge in there. And as we follow them, I didn't want the reader to be totally comfortable with them, or I want them to feel like I know these guys, but I don't know them. They're always going to surprise me a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I really enjoyed about the book is that these three characters are definitely from that sort of era where, you know, and I'm not like, I mean, I'm not one of these people that it's like, oh, things are terrible now, but it's from an era where it's like, maybe teenagers weren't necessarily supervised all the time. Maybe you were off sort of like getting into trouble, and maybe not everything was completely PC that you were doing. You know what I mean? Like it's from a like different era of like, growing up, where there was a bit more freedom, but there was a bit more, maybe to use your term, like jackassery involved, where you weren't necessarily thinking about what you were doing or how you were treating other people. Or am I correct in that?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that. You know, that's the other reason why 1977 is in the title, because it's not only about the movies, it's about the people watching the movies too.
Yeah.
And if I'd done the book 20 years ago, it would have been, the humor wouldn't have been as careful. Maybe it's kind of like when you watch the eternal reruns of Friends now, and everybody loves these reruns of Friends, and people are watching it that weren't even watching it in the 90s.
Yeah.
But some of the jokes, you're like, oh, you know, that doesn't play quite so well now.
Yeah.
Things have changed.
Yeah.
So that's been a challenge, but a challenge that I like about the book, that I wanted to go back there and kind of revisit that you're looking at it and, you know, I want to constantly be reminded that things have changed, but have fun with it, but not go too far with that, not be what would be offensive now, just to have fun though.
Sure. But I mean, one of the things that I do enjoy is kind of their sort of, and this is not to sound like on PC or anything like that, but their obsession with the teenage boy obsession with like, let's admit it, they're going to the drive-in theater to see, you know, women, or like these old movies where it was, things were a lot less, or things were a lot, let's just say, more loose. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that is one of the things that I liked about like these characters, is that they're not necessarily sanitized. They're not necessarily pulled back. It's very much the reality of what it was like to sort of be a boy growing up in that time, you know what I mean? Where you were just like, oh my God, like these things exist. Like I can find them. Like you were kind of on the hunt because you didn't have the internet. Like kids today, they can find anything. But back then it was like, oh my gosh, we can actually get into a drive-in movie and they show these. Or, you know, like maybe when I was younger, you went to the VHS store and you just hoped that the dude there was cool and let you, you know, rent Life Force or whatever, for whatever reason. You know what I'm saying? Am I making any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an area that I hope that hasn't really been revisited, and older people will kind of smile and remember, and younger people will be like a little bit mystified by it.
Yeah, I think so.
But those,
yeah.
Yeah, you like there was this whole cottage industry of the Roger Corman nurse movies and the cheerleaders movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
all these things that kind of take you back to the days where beyond Playboy magazine, you'd go to great lengths you would sit through things at the drive-in that you just shake your head at now. One of the jokes in the first issue is they're trying to get there in time to see this movie called Around the World with Fanny Hill.
Yeah.
And drive-ins back then would take these European sex comedies and they would slap a new American title on them or change the title. So you could see something one year and go back and think you were seeing a different movie. The same one with a different title. At that particular one, I think it's on YouTube now. It's so benign. And I challenge anybody to try to get through more than 15 or 20 minutes of it. But back then it was like, oh yeah, no, we'd watch that.
No, I mean, that's one of the things, like one of the movies that you mentioned is, I think, Scorchy or something that. Like that they go, and I had to look that up. I had not seen it, but I looked it up on the Internet Movie Database, and it does not get the greatest reviews. But when I was looking through it, I was like, and researching it, I was like, oh, I know why you would sit through it. It's like you knew why. And that's the thing too, is what I also like about your protagonist is like there's a balance, right? It's like they're on the hunt for this sort of thing because their hormones are kind of going out of control, but they're also doing really stupid stuff. Like you look at it objectively and like these people are not necessarily the brightest bulbs on the sign, but they're kids, like they're teenagers, right?
Right. I wanted to kind of throw you right in with them the first issue and not have a lot of backstory and not see them at home or not see them anywhere else. And then the second issue unfolds little flashbacks and you get to know them a little bit better as you go. But you also don't need to know them better because, there's always a friends group with this similar kind of dynamic and that part of it's kind of universal.
Yeah. That is one of the aspects that I really liked, is sort of embracing this sort of dumb guy that we kind of all go through went through as young men, where it was just like obsessed with girls or sexual stuff when you're a kid, and just all the dumb things that you do because either you can't get it or you're obsessed with it or you're just like, you know what I mean? And it's just,
right.
And the second issue is a great outgrowth of all the behavior in the first issue, because I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but they're sort of confronted with a society that isn't necessarily appreciative of that. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's a really good sort of turn that it takes, in my opinion.
Yeah, I wanted a little bit of a Beavis and Butthead element in there, in that you set them up to be obnoxious so that then when things start happening to them, you laugh at it. There's a little bit of that they had it coming vibe. But
yeah.
Also, they're not, to their defense, they aren't actual idiots, and that comes out as it goes too. It's more like they're just misdirected in the 70s suburbs and they're creative, but they pour their creativity into meaningless shit kind of
thing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the sci-fi aspect of it too? Because I mean, there's, as I was reading the book, and I mean, I obviously could tell from the cover of the book, it's like driving, like some crazy stuff is going to happen. But when I was reading the book, I was like, and you know, the sci-fi stuff kind of gets introduced a bit early on. But were there any thoughts when you were sort of creating this book to just make it sort of like you said, like Dazed and Confused books without the sci-fi elements? Or was that always part of the plan when you were thinking of coming up with your idea? Because I mean, so much of the book, the early book, kind of like works on its own as an exploration, as what I was talking about earlier. And, you know, you sort of get this sci-fi aspect in, and that's, and it works, you know, for what you're going for. But were you ever just thinking about making it just that?
No, not really. I always thought there had to be the kind of 70s realism, or, you know, Dorothy has to start off in Kansas before she goes to Oz. I always thought it kind of had to jump. But the original idea was like, okay, they go visit these various genres, and the people familiar with these movies will recognize and react. And maybe when I first started chewing on this, as far as 20 years ago, it was maybe a little more literal. But then we've seen that, you know, we've seen the Woody Allen Purple Rose of Cairo, and we've seen things like that. And as it developed, it became more fun. Like, let's not have them go from one specific movie to the other, but let's kind of stir all these drive-in elements together and have them bump into each other. And you get a little bit of that in the second issue, because you get kind of a Valley of Guanji, Ray Harryhausen type dinosaur thing.
Yeah.
And then an Elvis type 50s rocker.
Yeah, that's great.
Comes to the rescue. And then they end up in kind of a City of Lost Women. And that one is very specific. That's as close as I get to literally going into one movie, because they kind of go into Queen of Outer Space, the Zsa Zsa Gabor epic from the 1950s. But again, it's like, you know, that's somebody else's intellectual property, and we don't need to be too literal with that. But there's a panel or two where they first get captured, and it's kind of framed between the legs of the soldier women who capture them, and that is a frame, identical frame from Queen of Outer Space. And so as this goes on, you'll see things like that, hopefully one or two, three in every issue, that's like, okay, yeah, that one's a direct lift or a direct homage, but the story isn't. It's just that one visual is for people to get it.
Sure, sure. I mean, what I love about the introduction of the sci-fi aspect, or, you know, the dimension hopping station wagon and all that stuff, is just kind of like how wacky it is. You know what I mean? Like, there's this alien and he's been buried under the earth because he crashed years ago, and he's looking for people to help him go to another dimension and get fuel for his ship so he can go home. And the sort of devices that you're using to get the station wagon, I'm like, this is so out of the box, like, kind of crazy. But it works in the scope of your book, because it is very reminiscent of the crazy ideas of the movies that were embraced kind of like at the drive-in, right?
Well, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate you got that, and you said that real well. It's comedy comics, I have found, are not like the ones that I want to buy. And I'll explain, like, you know, that like if they did a Bill and Ted comic, right? And but if it's I think so. I hope so.
Is that the Evan Dorkin one? Like the
When you look at comedy comics, to me, they're drawn like what I would call the underground comics, or the R. Crumb.
Gotcha.
Or that kind of real out. It's kind of like a comedy comic. They're like, it's funny, and we're going to draw it funny to make sure you know it's funny.
Oh, gotcha. But,
so I wanted it to be, in fact, when I was trying to find my artist, my comparison was, I'd like it to be like Steve Pugh's work on the Flintstones. Oh. On Mark Russell's Flintstones book, I was saying I want it to be kind of comic realism.
Uh-huh.
That I wanted real faces and real expressions, and that, as you describe, the story and the dialogue would be funny. But as they say, of all good comedies, the protagonists don't know they're in a comedy. That's kind of what I was going for. If we could draw it as real as possible.
Gotcha.
And nail that kind of visual parody.
Sure, sure, sure. And your artist, the name is, at least the penciler, is Francesco Onorio. Is that correct?
Right. And he and I have never met. He lives in Italy. Oh, and wow. We found each other on the Facebook Connecting Artists and Writers group.
Oh, nice. That's very cool. So how did you get into comics? I mean, I know from just like the emails that first of all, I should say, like, you're an expert on like Las Vegas, right? Like on pop culture, it seems like that's one of the things. What's the name of your book? The book that you wrote about Vegas?
Right. That was my day job for about 30 years. I was an entertainment reporter at the Las Vegas paper, the Review Journal.
Gotcha.
And my book is called Cult Vegas, kind of a play off cult movies. And subtitles, The Weirdest, The Wildest, The Swinginest Town on Earth. And I will explain that when I wrote that, when I started that book in the late 90s, I was totally trying to cash in on the swing revival,
Of course.
best known from the movie Swingers. And then Capitol Records got in on it by putting out what they called the Ultra Lounge series. And all of a sudden, you know, when the 90s grunge thing and Nirvana and all that kind of people were looking for a counter weight to that, I guess. And so all of a sudden, everybody traded in their flannel and Doc Martens and started putting on suits and derbies and
Oh, I lived it.
swing dancing.
I was in LA at the time, and I mean, I still am in LA, but like I lived through all that and in that neighborhood, Los Feliz, where they shot Swingers and stuff like so. It's like, I recall very
Okay,
well.
it's a little close to home to you then. Well, it's funny, the book came out in 2001, and it did, from the cover art to the whole approach, it is that, and it worked to a degree. But what happened over the years is like a lot of the people that I did the primary interviews with have passed, and you can't go back and talk to them anymore. And the book sort of stands beyond that narrow angle as kind of an entertainment history of Las Vegas that I kind of did by accident, or kind of captured by
Oh, got
accident.
it. Oh, that's
And
cool.
so I don't know when you're going to put this up, but as we speak, tomorrow is the second of four CNN part documentary about Las Vegas called Sin City. And I'm one of the people they interview in that.
Yeah,
And
I
that's
was going to mention
primarily.
that you're such an expert on Vegas that you're like on a CNN show that, interviews people about the history. I watched the first episode because you let me know about it, and I was like, it was really good. I very much enjoyed it.
Thanks. Yeah. I obviously don't have any, I'm just on camera on that. I didn't have
That's
any
great,
behind the
though.
scenes. It is kind of a roundup, the usual suspects. There's about a half dozen of us that are kind of the go-to people for Vegas history now, and all of them are seen in the documentary.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm not a drinker or a gambler or anything like that, so I've never really been like into Vegas, but you lived there for a long time and reported on the entertainment scene. Like, what was that? I mean, it's kind of a silly question to ask, but what was that like? Like it must have been insane.
Yeah, it really was like being in the right place at the right time. And usually people that are end up getting rich because of that. But I missed that part of the ride. But it really was interesting to get here right as kind of the death throes of the old Vegas and watch what you see today sort of go up. It's kind of like Instant City, just add booze.
No, I mean, that's, it's really funny how it's changed over, because I mean, I was lucky enough that my mother took me on a road trip out west. I'm from the East Coast. When I was like 17 or something, and I couldn't go inside the casinos, but I was in Vegas, so I still saw it before it morphed into that, what it is today. But either way, I've just like, how long did you live in Vegas?
I got here at the end of 87.
Oh,
So,
wow.
yeah,
Okay. And
it
you're
really
still in
was.
Vegas?
I live in the suburbs. I live in Boulder City where Hoover Dam is.
Gotcha.
But
Oh,
yeah.
okay. Oh, great. Oh, wow. And are you still like reporting on Vegas, or have you retired from that or left like?
A little bit. I've gone freelance and I still contribute some to a city magazine called Desert Companion and various other things that pop up. But things like this drive-in project, you always said if it's kind of like I got my bluff called if I didn't have to drive up the road and sit in a cubicle all day, I'd be doing this and this and this. And so while I still had time and energy, it's like, well, let's quit talking about it and let's do it. So this
Oh,
drop book is one of those things.
gotcha. So, okay, so you've been reporting on the Vegas entertainment industry for a long time. You're such an expert that CNN or whoever's producing a CNN documentary is like, "Hey, Mike, come in beyond this," which is, is very cool in my opinion. Obviously, I think that should be cool to anyone. So, where do comics come into the picture? Like, how did you go from being an entertainment, sort of like reporter in Las Vegas to kind of making your own comic? How did that, what is your secret origin story?
That is question maybe still in the answering, but I, I'm a lifelong, well, near lifelong comics fan. I,
Okay.
going back to junior high days and being able to score the early issues of things like Swamp Thing and Tomb of Dracula when they were
Oh.
new. Yeah, and so what do they say? Lifelong listener, first time caller. Kind of like
Yeah.
that. Lifelong comics fan, so I certainly understood. I thought I understood the format and how it worked. And then, like a lot of us, when the pandemic and lockdown came and we were all stuck at home, I tried some things. I have written a one act play. I don't know if anybody will ever see it or if it would ever be produced. So I did that, and then the logical thing would have been a prose novel, right? Because it doesn't involve anybody else and
Sure.
nobody has to get caught up in my web of madness. But I just couldn't get anywhere with it. And then this one was an idea that had gone way back. And I don't know, it just kind of, I liked the challenge of it. I was like, boy, I thought I knew about comics, but how do they like, am I the one who decides how many panels are on a page, or does the artist decide how many panels are on the page? Well, there's no artist in the room with me, so I guess this page has five panels, and I guess this page has four. And I just kept writing until I have 12 completed scripts for this,
Oh, wow.
and that's the whole story. And that made me feel like, okay, I could do this because I think I can stick the landing. And there's an explanation for all this. It takes its sweet time, but I think I've answered all the questions about why all this is happening in the book. But the fact that with Kickstarter is a very slow process and long gaps between books, I have time to go back and get those 12 scripts into shape. And possibly even, if I decide to do them as 10 books instead of 12, things like that. It's like they're all just here in my laptop. They're not out there in the world yet.
Gotcha. So one of the questions I always like to ask people who, kind of like dove into comics, like what was the learning curve like for you? I mean, you mentioned like, oh, I don't know who determines how many panels are on this. Like, what sort of research did you have to do? I mean, were you still actively reading comics when you decided to do this? Like, what if you were, I mean, I would imagine you were well versed in the language of it, right? Like, if you've been a lifelong comics fan, correct?
I think so. I think that, and a lot of trade paperback and collected editions actually put scripts in the
Yeah.
back, and that helped me. And one thing it made me realize, like, well, as long as you can communicate with the artist, there's no ex standard form like there is with a movie script, and that where you submit a spec script that if it's not in the right format, they won't even read it.
Sure.
So it's not like that. But also, when I could read these collected, when I could read the scripts, I was like, okay, yeah, this, as long as the artist knows what you're talking about, I learned that.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, those other questions are still kind of being worked out. Like, I'm like, well, 20 pages, 24 pages, 22. And I had a friend that had put out some independent books for a while, kind of had a little independent line. And he got tired of answering questions, but he was very helpful. And on that particular one, it's like, well, if you're putting it out, if you're publishing it, it's as many pages as you want it to be. And
like, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So who did you go to like for advice on like what you were doing? Because quite honestly, the end product is great. Like, I mean, it looks very professional. It looks like something that you would, you know, I mean, again, my podcast is called Part-Time Fanboy. So I interview all stripes of like creators, you know what I mean? And as a hobby, you know, I've been working on like a little comic for years and years and years when I can't, you know what I mean? It's a hobby, but like the end product of what you've got here looks like something that you would see in a comic shop or in a bookshop. Like it's very professionally done. I mean, it's professionally illustrated, it's professionally colored, it's professionally written, like everything looks great. So, you know, for me, it's always interesting when somebody goes from not having ever done this before to actually making a product that looks like really, really solid, you know? Did you have to go seek advice? Did you just read books? Did you like what did you, how did you start approaching this, you know?
Well, a little bit of the all of the above, you know, it went from sitting on the, in the living room during the pandemic, writing these scripts to the part of me that was a newspaper reporter for so long is like, we love the editors, we hate the editors, you know, we curse them, but you have to have them. Uh-huh. And I was like, man, I need an editor on this, but, and I know you can hire one, but in this case, I just, there's these guys that, that are improv comics that do a pretty popular podcast. And, you know, I had one of them read it, and I had friends who are illustrators read it. And this friend, PJ Perez, who's more into documentary filmmaking these days, but he's the one that had the kind of small indie label called Pop Goes the Icon. I pestered him. So it took a village to kind of shepherd this thing along.
Uh-huh.
And then when Matt James, the colorist in Australia, is real helpful about like, you know, well, we could do this or this won't work. And this is why. The letterer, Amal, had good input. It just, you know, you get kind of a trusted circle of friends, and some you're like, I know you turn to them because they know about comics, and some you turn to them, they don't know any more about comics than I do, but you're just looking to them for story points, or do you understand this, or does this read?
Sure. Sure, sure. And I'm sure as a fan of like movies and cinema and stuff like that, at least like visually, when you were thinking of like what you wanted, like that helped, right?
It did. That's the part where you do realize you're in a collaborative medium. And a lot of times the artist is going to have a better idea than what you had in mind.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll be like, you could tell he like, okay, I like, that's cool, but we're for continuity or for this story point, you can't do that. You got to do it a different way. But more often than that, they'll surprise you and they'll be like, wow, this is cool. I didn't expect this. You know, you really surprised me here. If it was a movie, if this Drive-In Kings was made into a movie, it would be really literal. I could see the film stocks changing, you know, like when they go to Queen of Outer Space, it would be that kind of 1950s, I don't know if it's Technicolor, Eastman color, but that kind of gaudy, bright color. And then when it changed to a different genre, you know, the film stock would change and the art design would change. And I kind of realized in a comic book, you can't quite do that. It has to be consistent. And you can kind of reference that and keep that in mind, but it really has to be its own thing.
Yeah.
And they kind of taught me that. Whereas in my mind's eye, I was like, oh, it would look this kind of, where we're kind of playing with this movie, it would look different than when we're playing with this movie.
Yeah.
But the artists kind of teach you that, well, that's a nice idea and we'll reference that, but you can't totally do that.
Sure. And for you as a journalist, like how, What is the shift between journalism in your brain and sort of like creative writing, or at least like writing a comic book script? Like, how did you, what was your approach to writing the script? Was it like, you know, there's always like the DC versus Marvel, like where you like, this is panel one, page one, here's a caption. In this, you know, in this sequence, the boys are like trying to climb on the roof of the house. Like, how hard was it to shift in your brain from journalism to creative writing? And then once you did the creative write, made that shift, how hard was it for you to embrace the sort of like format of the comic book script so that, you know, an artist could understand what you were talking about?
That was the hard part for me. That was the big personal challenge, because the thing that made it hard and easy were the same thing. It was like, I was used to writing thousands of words, you know, sitting down in front of a blank screen and filling it. But it was always newspaper copy, you know, it was always nonfiction. So a lot of writers, creative fiction writers, would be like, wow, I can't get started. You know, I'm locked. I didn't have that problem. I'm used to just sitting down and like, okay, start typing. But then the fact that I hadn't written fiction in a very long time and all my published work is nonfiction, that was the huge challenge. That was the big thing to try to get that, wake up that part of the brain and get those muscles working.
Yeah.
And that I, you know, maybe it took the pandemic and the lockdown to do that, or maybe it was just that training of, if you start and you just start walking and someday you'll get there.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, it's always interesting to me to talk to writers who have either maybe worked in film or, you know, novels and things like that, because, you know, I have collaborated sometimes with people who are like writing a book or trying to, you know, coming from another field to create a comic book. And for some people, it's really hard to get that grasp of like, oh, page one, panel one, like what? And then wait, caption, and then word, you know what I mean? And getting through those steps. But it sounds like once you sort of made the shift to creative writing, like it was fairly easy for you to like embrace that template or that way of writing.
It's getting better, and the later scripts get more confident, I think, and it seemed like it got easier to write those. Now, whether that'll be reflected in what anybody reads or not, but it also goes back to what we were talking about the three guys and kind of weaving in some of our own infamous teen years and some of those stories we still tell all these years later. I was like, that made it a little easier to jumpstart this thing and figure out who these guys were. And on the other hand, though, I caught myself going like, well, now wait, no, these guys are not specifically me and my buddies, that, because why would you do that? It, you know, nobody else knows who we are. And why would you be like, oh, he can't say this because the real guy wouldn't say this. And it's like, no, there, it's not specifically us. It's, you know, we're making this up here, but that's what I said before about that strange mix of, you know, everything is part true and part lies, and you have to determine the percentage.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, as far as the inspiration for this, or like what are some of your favorite kind of like older movies? Like what are, I mean, it seems like you have a love for that kind of like B movie or lower budget, sort of like you mentioned Grindhouse earlier a little bit, cinema, which I enjoy as well whenever I get a chance to watch it. You know, I have a family and we share the TV, so it's not like I can just fire up whatever I want, whatever I want.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I mean, or the stuff that inspired Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez and stuff like that to a certain extent, right? Like what were some of the things that you loved like growing up, like, or the movies that stuck out in your head?
Well, it is that kind of whole B movie, cult movie thing. And me specifically, you know, I grew up on kind of the tail end of what they call the Monster Kids, and that was based on the famous Monsters magazine and the fact that the local TV stations would bundle the Universal horror movies run them usually with a late night host.
Yeah.
And so that and the Hammer movies, Big Hammer. I'm a big Hammer fan.
What's your favorite one? What are some of your favorites? Because I love the Hammer stuff. I just bought a Blu-ray box set. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, their first Dracula is kind of the gold standard. That's their. And then I like most of the Dracula sequels. Well, I like them all. I just ever shuffle the list of how I would rank them. And the Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed.
Yeah,
is great.
That's a good one. Yeah.
The Devil Rides Out, or known in the U.S. as The Devil's Bride, is one of their best.
Oh, I think maybe I've seen that one. I'm trying to watch their Phantom of the Opera again, because I have to share the TV, and you know, it's like stop and start in my home sometimes. And but I just I don't know that that's considered one of their better ones. It came in this box set that I saw that was on sale online, but. The thing that I'm always struck by, particularly when you get them on Blu-ray, is just how gorgeous everything looks, you know. And one of the reasons my wife sometimes likes to watch them with me, particularly, you know, the older ones, is because they seem like a period piece. Like, I mean, they are period pieces, but you understand what I'm saying? Like, it's like Howard's End or something, but they're schlockier. And am I making any sense there?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Their Blu-ray releases have really brought out those of us who used to watch them on TV on the late shows and probably 16 millimeter prints that were all scratched up. These restored Blu-rays just make you realize that even though they were low budgets, they were definitely kind of the old studio system where you had your in-house art director and your in-house set designer. They just look great.
Yeah.
and that Phantom of the Opera, by the way, that one is one that's kind of benefited from reappraisal in the Blu-ray era, because for years growing up, kids like us were like, well, it's not scary. It's supposed to be a horror movie.
Yeah.
But now kind of people see it for what it is and not what it isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it looks great. I mean, that's the thing that's so impressive, especially in this modern era. I mean, I love going to see things in the theater when I can, especially old movies. And unfortunately, I live like out in the San Fernando Valley, and all the revival houses are like in Hollywood or, you know, south of us. And it drives me nuts, because I'm like, we're in the Valley and there's all these people that work in the industry and love movies, but nobody has a revival house that shows. But the Blu-ray stuff, like when you look at it, like I said, it's just like the costumes look great. A lot of people disparage Blu-ray because sometimes, you know, you can see wires or whatever, or effects or makeup looks weird or stuff. But with the Hammer stuff, like, it just looks so sumptuous. You know what I mean?
Right. And even just little details like putting it in the right aspect ratio that those of us who grew up trying to catch them on TV or VHS, you know, because VHS was always 4x3, and you see them like, wow, this is widescreen. Oh,
yeah. It just looks great. Yeah. And if you're fortunate enough to have like a decent sound bar or whatever, it's just lots of fun. I mean, I love that stuff. Oh,
but the drive-in thing. Yeah. You know, just to quickly answer your question on that. Yeah. The book does stem out of like when the MST 3000 started, a lot of us were like, this is just me and my buddies, only they're actually funny instead of guys that just think they're funny.
Yeah.
But the drive-in thing, it did kind of quickly in the 70s, the late 70s, when the drive-ins were starting to close, and part of them branched off and did like the family mainstream movies. And then part of them ran what I would call drive-in movies. And that's of course what we were drawn to, and that could be everything from Godzilla to Women in Prison. But it's kind of like the definition of porn, you know, when the judge said, I know it when I see it.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of, I can't tell you what porn is, but I know it when I see it. So with me, the drive-in and anything under this huge umbrella that I put quote marks around and call it drive-in.
Yeah. You know, it's funny to me because one of the things I was thinking about before is like the drive-ins, they were outdoors, right? And it's just like this huge screen. And, you know, they would put stuff up with, like, I'm assuming nudity and violence and whatever. And it was just big and wide for everyone to see. And nowadays, like, how would that fly? Like, especially with how kind of like, you know, bunched up everyone seems to be about stuff like that. You know what I mean?
I think that is something the surviving theaters wrestle with. Yeah, because in the 70s, it was like, whatever, man. And now I think the surviving ones do have to deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm going to have to try and find a drive-in in California. I don't think there's many left, actually. There may be one. I'm not sure, but maybe I can take, convince the family to go see one and just for the experience.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Here on a podcast is not the right time to try to stumble for a name, but one of the suburbs as you drive in from Vegas, I think has a tiki drive-in that they saved an old drive-in and tricked it out as a tiki drive-in, if that's still there.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. Yeah. I like the themed ideas. That's very cool. Well, so Mike Weatherford, I really appreciate your time. Where can people find you online? Like, are you on the social media? Do you have a website? Like, where can people find you directly?
Yeah. I created a Facebook group for the book with the title of the book and then hyphen comic. So it's just Drive-In Kings of 1977 comic. That's a Facebook group, and on Instagram, I'm Drive-In Mike. And then my personal Facebook was more related to my newspaper career, but it's my actual real name, and you can find me on there.
Oh, cool.
And then we'll see where the X and the Twitter goes, but I'm still there at Mike Weatherford. I don't do much with it, but I haven't got off it yet.
Still so. On Twix. I'm telling people to abandon the Twix. It's a great candy bar.
One of my to-do lists before the campaign ends, I need to, what, Blue Sky is kind of where the comics
people are going. I'm trying to get away from social media, Mike. trying to drift away.
Says the guy with the podcast.
I know. It's a dichotomy, but I know. So Mike Weatherford, the book is called Drive-In Kings of 1977. I very much enjoyed it. I have enjoyed chatting with you. Go to Kickstarter, search for Drive-In Kings of 1977. I'm sure if you just type in Drive-In Kings, it'll come up.
I think by the time you type in Drive-In, it comes up.
Good for Kickstarter.
Kings locks it in.
That's
Kings
great.
Guarantees.
That's awesome. Well, I very much enjoyed the books that you sent me. I'm going to go contribute a bit. I like to help sometimes with just maybe the digital issues. I interview a lot of people, and a lot of people are always doing crowdfunding. So if I can at least help with the digital issue, I want to, because I very much enjoyed what you sent me. So thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your insight. It sounds like, you know, I always feel good. Like, oh, man, yeah, he gets it. He nailed it.
Well, as a journalist, how did I do, Mike? How did I do? As a journalist who's been working in Vegas for 30 years, what is your opinion of my...
Well, that's what I said. It's like, wow, what some of the things you summarized about it, I was like, well, yeah, right on, because that's what I'm aiming for, but you never know quite how it's going to land.
Yeah.
And so when people actually get it, it's like, yeah.
Oh, no, I got it. I get it. Yeah. And other people should get it too on Kickstarter, Drive-In Kings of 1977. Mike Weatherford, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, likewise. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely. Anytime. And you're welcome back anytime for as long as I'm doing, you know, I don't know, social media, whatever. Anyway, my name is Chris. Right. My name is
Chris. We'll meet in Barstow, man. We'll meet out there at the Barstow Drive-In.
Yeah, well, it's fine. I got to find it. Yeah, I've never been to one. But anyway, this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. You can check us out on parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. Instagram. We have Abandoned the Hellscape, that is Twix. Please go to Kickstarter and support Drive-In Kings. I very much enjoyed it. I mean, if you love like nostalgic, like you said, Animal House, kind of like fun, a little bit raunchy, but fun sci-fi humor. Check it out. And thank you for listening. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy. Fanboy.com.